Welcome to the series Revelation, The Second Coming, with your host, Father Alfred McBride. This series explains the imagery found in the book of Revelation and brings encouragement to the faithful. Now, join Father McBride as he presents this episode of Revelation, The Second Coming.
I heard a story not long ago about a stockbroker whose eyesight wasn't all that great, and he lived in Boston, and he wanted to go hunting on the weekend. He arose very early, about 4 o'clock in the morning, left for Maine, and arrived around sunrise, only to find out he had left his glasses back home. So he felt the safest thing for him to do was to stay in the open clearings, and time to time he'd raise his gun and look through the sight in the gun, and he saw this brown furry thing, but he couldn't quite make it out. So he was backing up a little bit and accidentally fell down a little hill behind him. So when he came to, he looked up at the top of the hill, and there he saw a 7-foot brown bear. And he folded his hands and he said, "Oh God, make that bear a Christian bear." Then he closed his eyes very tightly and folded himself in the fetal position. And when he opened his eyes again, there was the bear kneeling beside him with his paws folded in prayer and saying, "Bless us, O Lord, in these thy gifts, which we are about to receive from your goodness," and so on. Well, of course, that is not a true story, as you well understand, and doesn't have really a great connection with our study of the apocalypse, but I thought it would be a little comic relief as we get into this very serious and complicated subject of explaining the book of Revelation. We are at the present now in program 3 going to look through the letters to the 7 churches. Last time I gave you some historical and cultural hooks that will help you to remember that these churches, these cities, were real places. And it's important to know this because so much of the apocalypse is so symbolic and so dramatic that you really wonder, is there a real here somewhere? Is there a there, as someone has said? Anyway, these cities really do exist, did exist, and it's easy enough to point out their characteristics and how they entered into the mind of St. John. St. John presents Christ talking to each city, and in each of the 7 cases, Jesus appears with one of the characteristics that he showed to John in the vision, which we've already described in program 1. I think it's tremendous that EWTN has created such a beautiful set for this program, and I'd like you to just take one look again at the picture that shows St. John in ecstasy at Patmos. And there he is, he's looking at Christ, and Jesus will have many of the characteristics that are described in Apocalypse chapter 1. And I just point that out to you to show that what you are reading in chapters 2 and 3 are extensions of that same vision which John saw. So you have Jesus with the piercing fiery eyes or the feet of bronze, that means he's very firm and he's no pushover and he has no clay feet and so on. Now, in each of the cities to which these letters are sent, remember they are sent to the church communities, little house churches, all connected by a postal route or a post road, a post office road. In fact, we could show you, for possible, a way to connect them all. But you can see them on the map, and you can know that it made it easy, because the Romans had built good roads, easy for St. John, as a good pastor, bishop, metropolitan, to go around to each of these communities and visit his various house churches. Now, as he speaks to each one through the lips of Christ, or Jesus speaks through him, he points out in each church a virtue and then a sin, and then a reward for overcoming the sin. Now, we already in our last program spoke about Ephesus, and their virtue was that they really understood what the teaching of the church really is, or the teaching of the apostles. But at the same time, they had lost their first love. This means they had lost their first fervor, the enthusiasm they had for Christ and the church. And so Jesus says, I want you to get that back, and I promise you that if you recover your first love, as a reward you will eat from the tree of life. Next, Jesus goes to Smyrna, the letter to Smyrna through the writings of John. Remember, Smyrna is a rich seaport, but the Christians who live there are poor, and they have wonderful faith. They might be poor in money, but they are rich in faith, and they have kept the faith, and there is no criticism of any known sin or vice. They are simply good, good people, and they will receive the crown of life. And John is drawing that reward of crown of life from the mountain that is in back of the city of Smyrna, is Mount Pagos, or Pagus, and it was known as the crown of Smyrna. And so these good Christians will receive the crown of life if they remain faithful. The third city is Pergamum. And remember, Pergamum was well known for its parchment, also for its altar, the Pergamum altar, which is now in the Pergamum Museum in Berlin. And they're praised by St. John for not becoming pagans. They had resisted paganism. They say, well, would that all be all that hard? Well, it would in that city, because there was not only the altar of Pergamum, which was a big shrine, but also the shrine of Asclepius, the Greek god of medicine, which was a healing shrine. And they would be tempted to go there. It was, if I might say so without being too specific, it's like a Lourdes shrine, but of course it was not a true Lourdes shrine. Their problem was, though they resisted paganism, they did give in other ways. They ate food offered to the pagan gods, idol food. And the reason they did that and could do that is that in the butcher shops, you had regular meat at the regular price, and then you had discounted meat, if you will, or cheaper meat. The cheaper meat was that which had been offered to the gods, Asclepius, or at the Pergamum altar, but not consumed in the fire. There was always a certain amount of meat left over, and that was cheaper meat. The problem is that the Pergamum Christians didn't have a lot of money, and they were inclined to buy that which was cheaper. So they ate idol food, which was somewhat scandalous because it was food that had been consecrated to a false god. So he said, you shouldn't do that. Furthermore, they ran into the problem of pagan or sacred prostitution. These temples would have hired prostitutes who served as priestesses in their temple, and unhappily they served also as call girls in the local city. And unhappily also, some of the Pergamum Christian men took their services. However, though they ate idol food, if they overcome it, the reward would be they would be given the hidden manna. They would be given remember, the manna was the food given to the Israelites, and then Jesus gave us the bread of life. This, of course, refers to the Eucharist. The next city is Thyatira. Remember, Thyatira was over in the east. It was a fort town, a soldier city. That's where the Romans, you know, would deploy their soldiers to protect the eastern frontier of Asia Minor. The Thyatirans were good, loyal Christians. They had good faith, but like their friends, they also ate idol food and practiced sexual freedom. And if you're reading in this chapter 2 or 3 in Apocalypse, It is said that the one who tempts them into idol food and sacred prostitution is a woman named Jezebel. And they even imply it's a Jewish woman named Jezebel. Well, that's very unlikely, because no respectable Jewish woman would ever take the name Jezebel. She was one of the most sinful and hateable women of the Old Testament. She was the wicked queen of King Ahab, who did all kinds of terrible things we read in the book of Kings. So you can go back and read about Jezebel. But this is simply a symbolic name here. There is no one truly with that name. But St. John calls her by that name because in the mind of the readers who knew their Bible, they would understand what he was talking about. And then if the Thyatirans prevail over their sinfulness, they will be given authority over the nations. The next city we're going to deal with is Sardis. Sardis is a city that was wealthy due to its making of coins and of jewelry. You may have heard of King Croesus? Did you ever hear the expression, rich as Croesus? That's where it comes from. He lived in Sardis, and he was known as the richest man in the world. He was the Aristotle Onassis of his day. So it was a town known for its wealth, but also known for its greed. And unhappily, the Christians there also were rich and also were greedy. And that is what is being criticized and condemned here in this story. And so, because of that, it's thought that, for example, they may have bribed the Romans to leave them alone, and that would make it even worse. Now Jesus praises them for their he doesn't. He doesn't praise them for any virtue. This is one of the two cities that will have nothing good said about them. And Sardis is one. And the interesting thing is that both cities, which will have nothing to praise, are both guilty of greed and both are too much in love with money. Greed, as we know, is the worst of all evils. You say, well, are you sure? Who says so? Well, what about 1 Timothy 6:10? First letter to Timothy, chapter 6, verse 10. It says there, love of money is the root of all evil. Now, there are seven capital sins. Someone will say, well, lust is the worst evil. Others will say, pride is the worst evil. But what does the writer to Timothy say? The love of money is the most evil of all things, because it is the root of all evil. In fact, if you, as I did in high school, studied Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, one of the most interesting of the Chaucerian stories is the Pardoner's Tale. And remember, in the Pardoner's Tale, I could give you a little Latin from that, avaritia est radix malorum. The love of money is the root of all evil. And that's what John and Jesus are telling the parishioners, that greed has made them into the living dead. And greed is the most powerful thing, most powerful of the seven sins. Their song is, I am what I have, I am what I own. I don't know if you know people in your circle of acquaintances who are forever showing you the latest thing they bought, and of course it's very expensive, or the latest vacation that they took, where they went first class and went on some kind of a cruise or whatever. You get a little tired of them after a while because they're boasting of their wealth and how they are using it. Says to me, I am what I have, I am what I own. But how foolish that is. Jesus warns them that death will come like a thief in the night. He calls them the living dead. And They are, but if they overcome their greed, they will come alive, and they will be enrolled in the book of life. And one day they will, instead of being the living dead, they will wear the garment of the resurrection. It's a big challenge because they don't have any known virtues, and they have a terrible sin, so they've got a lot of spiritual work to do. The next city we come to is my beloved Philadelphia. Philadelphia was so named by the founder of that city, a man named Ptolemy, who was so fond of his brother that he named the city in honor of his affection for his brother. So that's where the word Philadelphia means brotherly love, the love of a brother. And so the man who built this city built it because he liked his brother. And so it's a city that not only has no vice, according to St. John, and Jesus has nothing bad to say about the Philadelphians. One thing I'd like to note is that of all the cities of that particular period, at the time that St. John was writing, so it's, you know, the end of the first century, of all the cities that survived for the longest time, Philadelphia survived the longest. It was still in existence in 1392, just 100 years before Columbus discovered America. So Philadelphia was, its virtue was that it never denied Jesus. The Philadelphians had no, they never betrayed Christ, they never denied him, and they had no vices for which they could be criticized. Now Jesus said to them, I see that you are poor and that you are powerless, that you have nothing. You're not going to be empowered, if you will. But he said, if you remain faithful, even in your weakness and lack of power, I will make you pillars of the church. So a pillar, of course, is very strong. And so Jesus says, in your weakness, I will make you powerful. And finally then, Laodicea, the last of the churches. Laodicea, again, like Sardis, whom we just spoke about a little while ago, Laodicea is also a very rich church, and it also suffers from the sin of greed, which we have just said is worst of the capital sins. It was rich because of its eye medicine that was very popular. It's called Phrygian powder. It was rich because of the wool industry and the embroidered dresses and suits which they made and shipped all over the empire. And above all, it was rich because it was a banking center. And it had branch banks all over the Mediterranean. They were the Medicis of their time. Remember, the Medicis were the great rulers of the city-state of Florence. Now, these wealthy Christians, well, everybody was wealthy, including the Christians, unlike, say, the Christians in other cities. Here they were rich, and their love of money compromised their faith. They were genial Christo-pagans, is what I would call them. And it's clear from the Apocalypse that these Christians were what we today call selective believers. They were cafeteria Christians. In other words, they believe what they like. And if they didn't like it, they didn't believe it. They said, to choose is self-legitimating. If I choose it, it's right. If I don't choose it, it doesn't matter. And so instead of, taking all of Christianity as it comes to us from Christ and the apostles and the church, they said, well, I'll have a little of that and a little of that. You see, I'll do what pleases me. And so Jesus calls them, he says, you are not hot Christians, devoted to Jesus. You are not cold Christians. You didn't give up all your faith, but I don't like you. Because you're not hot, you have no devotion, no fire, and because you're not cold, well, you know, you're in between. Because you are neither hot nor cold, I will vomit you out of my mouth. I will spit you out of my mouth. He doesn't like them too well. Now, I know God loves everyone, but he doesn't like the way they act, the way they refuse to have any sense of commitment. They're what I would call theology of compromise with the culture. We have them today. You could use that same description for our own time. We have our own cafeteria believers. We have those who say to the pollsters, I will not accept this and I will accept that. It's whatever I think is right, whatever I choose. Someone came to me not long ago and he said, I'm looking over the whole range of religions and beliefs, including Christianity, and the whole range of Catholic beliefs. And when I find what I think is just right, I will choose it. He said, what do you think of that? And I said, I don't think much of it at all. I said, you have it all backwards. I said, we don't choose Christ. Christ chooses us. Now, it's true. We do say, I choose the church, I choose Christ, and so on. But we choose it only in the sense that I have received from God this grace, this revelation, and I am responding to it. So these are rough words. Jesus says to them, I am rich and I have no need of anything. But you are wretched and poor and blind and naked. Now, this is rich people he's talking to. You are wretched and poor and blind and naked. You have no self-insight. That's verse 17, chapter 3. I wish you were either hot or cold. Even better if you were cold. Otherwise, I will spit you out of my mouth. Verse 16. By the way, the water supply in Laodicea was infamous for its tepid water. They couldn't get cold water out of the spring, and they couldn't get hot water. They just got this kind of vapid, tepid water. The local joke was, when you drink Laodicean water, just spit it out. And that's what St. John is referring to. Now, the people may have been indifferent to Christ, just as people today are indifferent to Christ and the church. Religious indifferentism has never gone away, and it's just as old as Laodicea. We may be indifferent to him, but Jesus is never indifferent to us. Never. Christ's love is always hot. I think that's the lesson of this particular part of the apocalypse. Jesus stands at the door and knocks at our heart. I'm going to knock here a little bit just so you get the sound of knocking. Jesus is knocking. There's a wonderful painting called, it's the painting of Jesus knocking at the door. It's based on this verse from the apocalypse. And it's a wonderful painting. You can find it in St. Paul's Cathedral. And what's interesting about it is Jesus has a lantern, and he's at this door, this gate, and over the gate, over the door, is all of these branches and vines. And that door has not been open for a long, long time. And there is no keyhole. Jesus doesn't have a key that he can use to get in. And he says, you know, behold, I stand at the door and knock. Because only I have the key that can open the door of our heart and let Jesus in. And so he pleads with them, and he says, if you let me in, you will dine with me in the kingdom. You will have a throne to sit on beside me. You will eat the Eucharist with me, you know. You know, I feast upon you, dear Lord, in the Holy Eucharist. For you are the bread of life. I knock, and Jesus is saying, and like Holman Hunt did so well in that painting, open the door. Come to the feast. Come to the Eucharist. Will they respond? You see, what will the Laodiceans do? Are they able to do it? You'll find then, as they say in the last overview of the seven churches, the Laodiceans have no virtues like the Sardis Christians. No virtues. They're too greedy. It has eroded their entire life of virtue. But at the same time, they have plenty of vices. And yet Jesus says to the Laodiceans, if you overcome, you will dine with me. Again, the point being that no matter how indifferent we might be to Christ, Christ is never indifferent to us. So we see in this wonderful outline that has been laid out for us that what we have here is the realism of the early Christian community. Despite the fact they were hardly two generations away from Christ himself, despite the fact that there were apostles that they could have known, and St. John, in spite of all that, they were not perfect, and they had all the same sins and vices, and happily, many of the virtues which we have. It's just regular parish life. And I think it's terrific that we've had these two programs to study that aspect of the apocalypse, because most people run right on to the seven vials of wrath and all of the fireworks we are going to see as the rest of the apocalypse will show. Meanwhile, I hope that you will be studying along with me in our next program, Program 4. Please read Chapter 5, I believe. Let's see. No, Chapter 4. Chapter 4 and 5, you want to read about the heavenly liturgy. And so read that, and I hope that you can get a copy of my book, The Second Coming of Jesus. Our Sunday Visitor puts it out. Local Catholic bookstores will have it. I think if you can get together with a few people, not just yourself, and study this and study the text of Scripture itself, I think you will be able to find this a fruitful experience. So I look forward to being with you again for the Liturgy in Heaven.
This has been Revelation, The Second Coming, with your host, Father Alfred McBride. Join us again at the same time next week for another episode of Revelation, The Second Coming.